We shouldn't lose sight of the fact that God also is the one who built the house. Okay, we're just trying to differentiate what story is being told. Let me give you an example. There's a book, I haven't read it, but someone was talking to me about it. It's called Confucius Lives Next Door. And it's about an American who's trying to get acculturated into Chinese culture as he's living there. And so he's making observations about the things that he encounters. And he found that people back in America asked him about the neighborhood that he lived in. And he described the kind of narrow streets and the facades of the buildings and how cramped they were and maybe the state of kind of the area of the city where he lived. And so he was describing his neighborhood. Then he went and knocked on the door of the person who lived next door, and he asked him to describe his neighborhood. And he talked about so-and-so who lived there and so-and-so who lived there and the people who used to live over here and moved somewhere else. And he talked all about the people. And it's just another way of understanding how you talk about things, what you choose out as being important. Now, even though in the ancient world they chose the home story, and as I'm suggesting in Israel, they chose the home story, again, that doesn't mean that God didn't build the house. There are many statements throughout the Old Testament. Things like, God laid the foundations of the earth. Even though that's using old world science, that's saying God built the house. It just doesn't tell you when or how or what that looked like or anything of that sort. And when we get to the New Testament, we find John 1, you know, that everything that was made, he made. Of Colossians 1, all things visible and invisible. Hebrews chapter 1, Hebrews 11, they're talking about the house story. That God has built that. So certainly, God is the builder of the house. But again, we're asking the question, what's the story that Genesis 1 tells? And I've suggested that's the home story. Now, there's another ingredient we have to pick up here. As we talk about whose home is it? I've already mentioned the idea that God has prepared this place for us so that he can relate to us, so that where he is, we are. Okay, we pick that up actually in Genesis 1, but it's something that we wouldn't necessarily have recognized. We read through Genesis 1, and we get to day 7, and it says, so God rested on the seventh day. And we've got a little bit of a problem, because we say, why would God need to rest? He doesn't get tired, doesn't need sleep, doesn't kind of wear down. What in the world's going on here? Now, if we think of the biblical text as a house story, we say, and what does this have to do with creation? What does this have to do with the cosmos? There's nothing material going on here. This shouldn't be part of a creation story. It must be kind of a theological tag-on of some sort, you know, about Israelite Sabbath or something. We don't know what to do with it, and we even go so far as to start talking about the 6 days of creation. Big mistake. Take the text as it is. The seventh day is part of the cosmology story, more than part of it. We ask, why would God need to rest? Well, that's because there's things that we don't understand about God resting. See, if you gave this text to an Egyptian or a Babylonian, ask them to read through it, and they would get to day 7 and they would say, oh, this is a temple story. And you'd say, what are you talking about? I mean, let me read it again. No, it doesn't say anything about temple. And they would say, it's all about temple. And you'd be frustrated. You'd say, how in the world are you getting that? See, here we're dealing with this high context, low context. Okay? In a high context situation, this is a temple story. Low context, we come in, we're outsiders, and we say, I don't see temple there. Well, but any ancient reader would. Because there's something that we don't know. When we ask, what does God's resting have to do with creation, they know exactly what God's resting has to do with creation. Because in the ancient world, gods rest in temples. And temples are constructed for deity to rest in. If you've got divine rest, you've got a temple. That's straightforward to them. That's as obvious as anything. We read it and we don't see it at all. Because we don't understand rest, and we don't understand temples. Okay, in the ancient world, not only are temples made for deity to rest in, temples are the command center of the cosmos. You know, in America, we have these presidential elections. You know, and so these candidates spend a couple of years trying to make their way to the White House. And I will guarantee you that is not so that they can sleep in the Lincoln bedroom. It's so that they can sit behind the desk in the Oval Office and take control of the country. Because just like the Oval Office is the command center of American politics and policy, the temple is the command center of the cosmos. And when deity took up rest in a temple, it was not to catch a snooze. It was to rule. So we don't understand temples, so we miss this, and we don't understand divine rest. We don't have to go to the ancient Near East, although we could. This is all over the ancient Near Eastern material. But we can look in the Bible and get this ideology, theology of rest. Think of it. When God tells the Israelites, I'm going to give you rest from your enemies all around, we don't think, oh, God's going to give them more naps. God's going to give them a chance to sleep. You don't read that text that way. You understand that the rest God is giving has to do with some order and stability in their society, in their country, in their life that is upset when enemies are invading all the time. Rest is about God bringing order for them and trying to give them some control over their daily lives. When Jesus says, come to me, all you who labor and heavy laden, and I will give you naps. No, I'll give you rest, but what is that rest? It's not extra sleep time, sleeping in on the weekends or something like that. God is going to give them a higher level of order and stability as members of the kingdom. And so we take his yoke upon us. It's not relaxing. It's finding order of a different sort at a different level. When Hebrews 4 says, you have not yet entered that rest. Again, he's talking about the order and stability that comes to us as members of God's kingdom that is still more yet to come. Rest in the Hebrew Bible, rest in the Bible as a whole, doesn't have to do with sleep or relaxation or leisure or naps. It has to do with order and stability. When God rests, he ceases his ordering activity in order to do what he ordered it all for. God ordered the cosmos to rule over it, to take command of it. Again, we go back to the analogy, if you've just moved into a new apartment or new house, you've got all your boxes all over the place. It's unordered, unorganized, non-functioning. And so you spend a lot of time unpacking the boxes, putting everything where it belongs, arranging the furniture, hanging things on the walls, right? Making it your place. And you're bringing that order so that you can live there. You're not going to do all that and then walk away and say, well, that's done. Now I can take a nap and be on my way. You did it so that you could live there, so that you'd have that ordered space to live your life. God orders the cosmos so he can live in it. Sacred space, his place. We call that temple. A temple is in the ancient world how they architecturally marked sacred space, where God's presence was. God's presence is not really about a temple. It's about God being there, and therefore that space being sacred. The building doesn't create sacred space. God's presence creates sacred space. And so God is preparing it to be his home, his temple, sacred space. He's planning on moving in. He has ordered it for that purpose. Psalm 132, let us go to his dwelling place. That's the temple. Come to your resting place. See, his dwelling place is his resting place. Lord has chosen Zion for his dwelling. This is my resting place, and here I will sit enthroned. Rest equals rule. God has ordered this world to be sacred space where he will rule, but more importantly, where he will live with us, because he didn't make it to work for him. He made it to work for us. And he wants us to be here with him. That's the design of the cosmos, to be in relationship with God. God had prepared the house in what ways, over what time span, the Bible doesn't tell us. But there came a point where that house was ready to become a home. God was ready to bring his people into this place and to take up his dwelling there and to be with us. There is heavy, significant, poignant theology here that we miss entirely if we just read it as a house story. People may be the climax of the 6 days, but rest is the climax of the creation account. If God doesn't move in, it doesn't mean anything. If it's just a house that we're living in all by ourselves, it doesn't mean anything. It's God's place. The whole objective of creation is rest. And to make it a 6 days of creation, you've left God out of the picture. You say, well, God built the house. But it's not just that God's a house builder. It's his home. And we dare not miss that theology. Rest is the main goal of creation. Resting expresses having control over an ordered system. And that's what God's doing. The opposite of rest is not activity. Rest is engagement, not disengagement. When Christ says, is he going to give us rest? He's not asking us to disengage. He's asking us to engage in the kingdom work and the kingdom identity. Rest for the Israelites was not disengagement. It was engagement in life, uninterrupted by people invading them. When God rested, he was not disengaging, although he was done the ordering work. But that means we are ready to engage in the real thing, God taking up his dwelling. When God gives rest, then he resolves unrest. It's engagement. Okay, so we're using this temple idea. So think about it. Solomon, okay, spends 7 years constructing the house. The stone, the gold, the furniture, the priest's vestments, the veils. Solomon spends 7 years constructing the house. That's the house story. And we get a little bit of the house story in Kings and Chronicles. When all of that's done, the structure is built, it's finished, it's completed, and there it stands in front of you. You can see it. It exists materially. Does the temple exist? You'll find when I ask a question, it's usually a trick question. Okay? Just saying. Okay? Does the temple exist? No, it does not. Because temple does not describe a building. Temple describes a function. It's not a temple if God isn't in it. So they've built the house. It is not a temple, but it is ready to be a temple. And something has to happen for that to transpire. What is it? How does it turn from a house to a home? From a structure to a temple? From a place that's empty to a place that is God's command center? How does that take place? I mean, we should be real interested in that now because that's kind of what we're suggesting is going on in Genesis 1. So what happens to make that take place? Well, we read it in the Bible. And for that matter, we read it all through the ancient Near East as well. We have loads of temple texts in the ancient Near East. Temple building was one of the most important projects that a king could undertake in the ancient world. So we've got loads of texts talking about this. Okay, so how does it take place that it becomes a temple? There is an inauguration ceremony. The temple dedication ceremony, 1 Kings 8, okay, read it in the Bible. They had it for the tabernacle. Chronicles tells it again. They have it in the post-exilic Ezra Nehemiah temple. A temple inauguration ceremony that is meant to officially transition from just a structure that's all prepared and ready to a temple where God is. And of course, what happens in those temple inauguration ceremonies? Follow this carefully. First of all, they proclaim the functions of that temple. So they'll say, people can come here and they can pray and God will hear them and he'll hear their voice, he'll have favor on them and answer their prayers. Functions. Rituals will be performed there, okay? Functions. Then they install the functionaries. I hope this is sounding familiar. Okay, they install the functionaries, the furniture, the priests are commissioned, okay? Rituals are begun. And then what happens? God rests in that temple. And then it's a temple. The transition between the house story and the home story takes place in the temple inauguration. Those temple inaugurations take place over a period of 7 days. If we ask the question, what is the importance of 7 days in Genesis 1? We're asking that question because it's sure confusing if we think it's a house story. But if we think of it as a home story connected to sacred space, God's place, God's home, temple, if we start thinking in those terms, then the 7 days is actually the time usually that's used to transition from the house to a home. I should talk about observance of Sabbath, but I know one of you will ask that question in the question time, so I'm not going to do it now. Okay. So, 7 days. So let's think about that. Usually, we ask a question like, are these 7 literal 24-hour days? Now, we wouldn't care about that question, except that we think this is a house story. And if it's a house story, then the 7 days has to do with the time period over which God made the house. And so we have different ideas about the house, this cosmos, and so we're worried about those 7 days. Does that mean that the house is young, the house is old? And so we usually think that's the issue. So we ask, how long is the day? Because that usually concerns the age of the earth issue. But you can see that if this is not the house story, but the home story. If this is not a material account, but a functional account. If this is not about objects, but about order. Then these 7 days are not about the age of the earth. Because that's the house story. The age of the earth is the material thing. If this is not the house story, those 7 days don't have anything to do with the age of the earth. Now, for the record, let me say clearly, I think the days are 7 24-hour days. But see, once you've looked at the text as a home story instead of a house story, who cares? That doesn't even matter anymore. Stick with me, I'm moving fast. Okay, so, you see, it changes the whole complexion of it. Because if this is not a house story, then those 7 days can be 7 literal 24-hour days, just like they are in temple inauguration ceremonies, right? And that would have nothing to do with the age of the earth. If the 7 days is like a temple inauguration, then the objects are not being made in those 7 days. Remember, the house was already prepared. If the days are concerned with bringing order rather than making things, the 7 days has nothing to do with the age of the earth. That means that the Bible does not make a claim about the age of the earth. Right? If the 7 days are not about the age of the earth, if it's the home story, not the house story, then the Bible does not have any claims to make about the age of the earth. Maybe it's old, maybe it's young, maybe it's a dream. It just doesn't have a claim to make. If the Bible doesn't have a claim to make, then we say, okay, I checked that out. Now I can look at the science and decide what I think works, what makes sense. And maybe you'll decide it's young, and maybe you'll decide it's old. I'm not here to solve the science for you. But we have to make sure, do we have that doorway to go through of the Bible to say, no, the Bible shuts the door or opens the door. The Bible makes a claim or doesn't. And I'm suggesting the Bible does not make a claim. Now, I might be wrong on this, but I don't think I am. But I might be wrong. But in my experience, people who believe the earth is young believe that because they believe the Bible requires it of them. I haven't run into many people who would say, even if the Bible didn't say anything about that at all, and if Genesis 1 didn't mean anything about that, still, on the strength of the science, I believe the earth is young. I don't run into people like that. Because the next sentence they'd be talking about, now, I know the earth looks old, but here's how that works. They acknowledge the earth looks old. They're holding on to that young earth view, and maybe it's some of you, and I don't want to step on any toes here, but they're holding on to that young earth view because they believe the Bible requires it of them. I admire that. I was that for 30 years, 40 years, because I didn't know what else to do with the text, and I fully believed that the day would be a 7 24-hour days. So I admire that you would hold on to that in the face of what other people say, scientists says, because you believe the Bible requires it of you. I always believe we should do what we think the Bible requires of us. And we might have different opinions about that. That's okay. But I just want you to see where I'm coming from. That this issue, age of the earth, is a question about what the Bible requires. And sometimes people answer that by saying, well, I read the Bible literally, and it says 7 days, so I think it's 7 days. I agree. It says 7 days, I think it's 7 days. What's happening in the 7 days? That's the question. And people have never thought to say, oh, is it a house story or a home story? That's just not been a question on the table. Did people throughout church history think that it was a house story? Yeah, they did. But they weren't trying to explore, get into what the ancient world thought. They were trying to deal with the world in front of them. Okay? Did they also recognize the heavy functional aspect? Oh, yeah, they did. But again, they weren't asking the questions we ask. And they weren't asking the questions that the ancient world asked. Our earliest interpretations of the Bible are already firmly within the Hellenistic period, already influenced by Aristotle and Plato, already thinking in Greek terms, not Hebrew terms. They've already lost the ancient Near East by the time we get to the earliest biblical interpretation, whether it's Christian or rabbinic or pre-Christian times. We've already lost it. That's why I call the book The Lost World of Genesis 1. And our only way that we've recovered it is through the archaeological excavation of this million-plus cuneiform texts that help us recover the ancient world. I'm not trying to give you a new view. I'm trying to give you the old view, the ancient way of thinking. Conclusion, the text asserts that in the seven-day initial period, God brought the cosmos into operation by assuming roles and functions and playing nice music. No. Okay, sorry. Okay? So, now that's my paraphrase of Genesis 1:1. Right? The seven-day initial period, that's the beginning. See, because in Hebrew, that word beginning does not refer to a point in time, it refers to initial period of time. And the initial period of time is the 7 days. So in the beginning, that is, in the seven-day period, God brought into existence an operation. That's operations, roles, functions, order, That's what God was doing. That was the creative work. Yeah. Oh, yeah, I forgot I had these in. I've got about 5 slides here on cosmogony, cosmology outside Genesis, and we don't have time for it. But let me tell you, let me go to the conclusion one. These are just different things that are there. Yeah, yeah. Oh, it's great stuff. But, you know, okay. Emphasis on rule, emphasis on functions, just all through the Old Testament, notable statements. God formed summer and winter. That's not material, is it? Created the north and south. I mean, look at this language. Mountains born, planted the cedars of Lebanon. Conclusions. We have different concepts. You know, sometimes God stretches out the earth. Genesis 1, the earth emerges. Doesn't matter. God did it. Okay? Uses verbs, make, form, create, things that we think are very material. You can find them all over the place in the Old Testament where they're not material at all, like I just showed you, created north and south. You know, mixes ongoing with initial, to say God created at a beginning point, but then to say that he's ongoing in creation. We find that all over the place. It attributes the material cosmos to God. Certainly it does. He is the house builder. But it's more interested in function, order, and God's control and rule. There is no difference, we find, between the poetry and prose. Some people say, oh, well, Job, it's Psalms, that's poetry. Now, you find the same kind of language and use language in prose. So that doesn't really make a difference. So there's really nothing in the rest of the Old Testament that gives a different kind of picture than this. Okay. Now we need to move to Genesis 2 and 3. So by this point, people are often saying, okay. You've persuaded me that there's a really strong functional emphasis here. All right, I get it. Fine. But that's Genesis 1. Genesis 2. God formed Adam from the dust of the earth. Doesn't that just scream material to you? Not to me, it doesn't. Because I'm reading the Hebrew terms, and they're not near as material as it makes it sound. I mean, we have to translate the word somehow. But let's take a look at the language and its usage and find out what it means. Adam. The word Adam is a Hebrew word meaning humanity. So already we've got some troubles. We tend to put a capital letter on it and treat it as if it's a personal name. Okay, but that's like saying, you know, and God created humankind, humanity. I mean, it's not a personal name, especially when it has a direct object on it. A definite article on it. Definite articles, the in English. You know, your names don't have definite articles connected to them. Hi, I'm the John. You know, no, that's in the men's room. Okay? So, yeah, that one always works. So, so names don't have definite articles on them, and lots of the places through Genesis it does. We have some without the definite article. 5 times it is a personal name, but that doesn't start till late in chapter 4. You know, by that time you're talking about Adam having relations with his wife Eve. That's just Adam, okay. And in 5, we get to the genealogies. 4 times it's humanity as generic, okay? So God created Adam. Male and female, he created them. Okay, there it's generic. Okay, with the definite article, which is almost all the occurrences in chapters 2 and 3. With the definite article, it kind of talks about the archetypal human. That kind of idea. So we have the usage of Adam, which can be more confusing, and translation makes a big difference of how you render it. More importantly, at this stage, we have a literary introduction in chapter 2, verse 4. That's where it says, these are the accounts of the heavens and the earth in the day that the Lord God created them. Okay, it's a literary introduction, and there are 11 of them. This is the generation of Adam. This is the generation of Terach, of Jacob, of Isaac, okay? Generations. So those are literary introductions that structure the book of Genesis. Now, This literary introduction is very important to us because we want to know what is the relationship between chapter 1, the 7 days account, and chapter 2, the Adam and Eve account. Most of us have thought that chapter 2 is a detailed description of what goes on in day 6. You're all saying, yeah, of course I thought that. What else could it be? I'm glad you asked. Do you see again our process? Making an observation, asking a question, doing some research. Okay? Our analysis requires us to ask questions and then be willing to be thinking in new ways. That doesn't mean new ways are always right or new ways are always better. But we always have to be willing to think beyond the box that we're in, else there's no hope. Remember last night I talked about being willing to be surprised by the text. We can't be surprised by it if we're not willing to kind of wipe the slate clean a little bit and read it fresh. So we instead of saying, I know what the relationship between chapters 2 and 1 are, we ask the question, what is the relationship? And does this introduction help us? After all, remember that if we believe that chapter 2 is telling us about day 6, we've got some problems. There are problems we've swept under the carpet, but there are problems. One is sequence. In Genesis 1, animals are created and then people are created. In Genesis 2, it's the story of Adam formed from dust and then God formed the animals. Now, if you read like the NIV translation, they translate, now God had formed the animals. Ooh, nice try. Whoa, doesn't work. Hebrew has a way of doing that, and that ain't it. They're trying, because they realize there's a problem. There's a worse problem. If you're thinking about the days as 24-hour days, you've got Adam naming all the animals. Whoa, that's a busy first day. For Adam, naming all the animals, you know. God had to make him and plant the garden and all of that, and we still have Eve coming, okay? And he's got to name all the animals. And, it, you know, sun's going down and we're still in the beetle species, you know, 5,408 species, you know, and boy, there's so many more to go. Okay. You only hadn't even gotten to the Rolling Stones yet. So, okay, stay with me. Beatles, Rolling Stones. Okay, I'm working. So there are problems with this whole thing. So how's it going to work out? Well, one of the possibilities might be to say, well, maybe chapter 2 is not dealing with day 6. Well, that solves some problems, but in your minds, probably immediately, you can think of other problems that it creates. You can imagine some problems here. So let's think about it, though. Okay, so I took all of the 11 occurrences, that's 10 of them, of course, Genesis 2, 4 is the other one, the 11 occurrences of this literary introduction. And I said, what's going on before it and what's going on after it? In other words, what's the relationship? If Genesis 2 is moving back to talk about day 6, that would be what we call synoptic. It's doubling back. Just like in the Gospels, you know, Mark tells the story of Jesus' ministry, Matthew kind of doubles back, says the same thing, Luke doubles back, says the same things, different ways, but that's synoptic. It's covering the same material again. Okay, so if chapter 2 is day 6, that's synoptic. But lots of the others are sequels. Sequel is not doubling back, it's moving forward. It's saying, so what came next? Okay, so some of these introductions are introducing synoptic passages. Others are introducing sequel passages. Well, it's very important then for us to ask, is there a way we know whether it's one or the other? I mean, after all, if Genesis 2 is synoptic, it's day 6. If it's sequel, then something else is going on. How would we know? Well, I took a look at them all. Is there something that's characteristic of the sequel ones and is characteristic of the synoptic ones? And it turns out there is. All the examples of synoptic relationships concern brothers. So it tells the story of Cain comes back and gets Seth. It tells the story about the sons of Noah comes back and gets Shem. It tells the story of Ishmael comes back and gets Isaac. It tells the story of Esau comes back and gets Jacob. All the ones that are synoptic deal with brothers. If it doesn't deal with brothers, it's a sequel. Does Genesis 1 and 2 deal with brothers? No. That doesn't prove anything. It just says we ought to think carefully about this idea that it could be a sequel. Now, that starts blowing our brains because we say if it's sequel, then the people in the first account, Genesis 1, day 6, those people are not necessarily and probably not Adam and Eve. After all, Genesis 1 doesn't mention Adam and Eve. Genesis 1 doesn't say that there are just two people. Genesis 1 could be a massive creation of people. We don't know. It doesn't say anything about it. And then Genesis 2, if it's a sequel, comes later. You say, but how can it come later? Because Adam and Eve, it presents them as the first people made. Does it? After all, we've got a little problems with that as we read through the biblical text. I'm not even talking about science. As we read through the biblical text. Because first thing we know, Cain's marrying someone. We've all asked the question, where does Cain get his wife? And that sister answer just isn't very comfortable. And then we find out, you know, God's driving Cain away, and Cain says, whoa, you can't do that. Anybody who finds me will kill me. Anybody? Who's the anybody? Mom and Dad? I'm sure they're upset, but they'll get over it. And then he's building a city. A city can't be just for you and your two best sibs who aren't trying to kill you and that you're not marrying. You know, there are things in the text that say something else is going on here. And it doesn't explain it. But those are things that could be resolved quite easily if there are other people around. So now the question is, how would we resolve the idea that Adam and Eve maybe weren't the first people? How in the world could the text support that kind of idea when it has them being formed? Now, the second account wouldn't need to fit into day 6. That would be handy. Okay? But how would it all work? What I would like to propose to you is that we need to think about Adam and Eve, the forming accounts of Adam and Eve, as archetypal. Everything in Genesis 2 regarding human origins, not everything else, but human origins, is first and foremost archetypal. Now, let me explain about an archetype. I'm not talking about a literary archetype. So for those of you who know that kind of thing, I'm not even talking about philosophy archetypes. An archetype is a word used in lots of different kinds of contexts. What I mean by an archetype is, first of all, not a prototype. A prototype is the first in a series. So they kind of make one, so they know how to set up the assembly line, and then they make lots of others, okay? That's a prototype. The difference with an archetype is in an archetype, there is representation. That is, all of the ones in the group are represented in that one. So, for instance, when Paul says that we all sin in Adam, he's treating Adam as an archetype with regard to sin. When we're told that Abraham is the father of all those who are in the faith, that's his archetypal role. Okay, even Jesus, as he does his work and provides life, is archetypal as the last Adam. Okay, so the Bible uses archetypes. The ancient Near East uses archetypes all over the place. I'm going to have to skip that slide, I'm sure. But there's plenty of examples all through the ancient Near East of this archetypal understanding of humanity. So this is common in the Bible, it's common in the ancient world, and we shouldn't be surprised that that kind of idea would be used. The forming accounts, I suggest, are most relevant to Adam and Eve as archetypes rather than as individuals. Now, don't get me wrong. I do still believe that Adam and Eve are real people in a real past. Historical Adam and Eve, I believe that. But that doesn't necessarily answer the science questions that I have. That's a statement about kind of the nature of this text. Adam is in a genealogy. I don't see anybody in the ancient world putting fictional people or something like that in genealogies. Now, So I believe Adam and Eve are real people in a real past, but we still have to sort out what role they have in this narrative. The forming accounts relate to them, I am saying, as archetypes rather than as individuals. You say, well, that's great that that's your opinion, but how would you know? How would you know if it's talking about them as individuals or as archetypes? They are identified as archetypal if the text refers to everyone, not just those individuals. So we're going to ask the question, is what the text says about Adam's forming true only of Adam, or is it true of everyone? If it's true of everyone, it's archetypal. If it's something distinct and unique of Adam, then it's individual. Same with Eve. So that's the question we're going to be asking to determine whether these forming accounts are archetypal or not. And you already know what direction I'm going, so I better get there. So, formed from dust. Let's think about this a moment. Sometimes when you think about Adam being formed from dust, maybe you think about chemistry. This is the stuff. This is chemical composition. God's doing the work. Well, first of all, Israelites wouldn't be thinking about chemistry. Their periodic table is very short. Oh, wait, they don't have one. But likewise, it would be bad chemistry because it's not an accurate description of the human body. More likely, you would think in terms of craftsmanship. That is, that God is molding the human form. I mean, it's a Pinocchio moment. I'm a real boy. You know, the idea that God has shaped him in order to breathe life into him, okay? Now, that's a great idea, but the problem is it's the wrong word. If the text were going to present God as a craftsman pulling together a human shape to breathe life into it, it would talk about clay, not dust. You can't shape dust. And if the whole idea is God shaping, then it would use clay, not dust. You form dust, yeah, that's not going to work. Okay, so it's not chemistry and it's not craftsmanship. What is it? See, again, we're doing it. Observation, questions, new research, thinking things you haven't thought before. So what is going on with dust? The text tells us. Yay, I love it when that happens. The text tells us. Genesis 3:19, dust you are and to dust you shall return. This is mortality. And now you say, hold it, wait a minute. Sir, let me take you to the Apostle Paul. And in Romans chapter 5, he tells us that death came through sin. The Apostle Paul believes that man was created immortal. At this point, one time I had a lady stand up and say I was heretical and stomp out, declaring me a heretic, because I said that people were created mortal. I'm sorry, I'm just saying what the Bible's saying. He's made from dust. You say, but Paul says he was created immortal. No, he doesn't. Think about Genesis 3 for a moment. God puts people in the garden, and in that garden he gives them two special trees, and one of those special trees is the tree of life. Immortal people do not need a tree of life. Give me a tree of money. No. Okay. No, immortal people don't need a tree of life. The Genesis text is treating them as mortals who need an antidote, who need a remedy. So what? Well, then what's Paul talking about? Well, think about it. They were mortal. They had a remedy, an antidote. They sinned and lost it. Therefore, through sin came death, because they forfeited the antidote. It's not that somehow they were immortal in their bodies and they disobeyed and whoof, now they're mortal. Oh, I feel the genes just collapsing. I don't mean my blue genes. It wasn't that. They lost the antidote. And so through sin came the fact that we are doomed to our mortality. People were not created immortal. We have to read the text. We're dust. Needed a tree of life. Death was part of the continuing non-order. Remember, just because God brought order into the system doesn't mean that all non-order was gone. The sea was still there. Darkness was still there. Death is still there. God's going to resolve it eventually. And the tree of life represented the hope of that future. But remember, life is not a product of a tree and its fruit. That tree and fruit in the garden was representative, symbolic of something more significant. Life is found in the presence of God. God is the source of life, and sacred space was where he was, and the fruit was symbolic of that hope. And when they sinned, they lost the hope for life in the presence of God. And that is eventually restored in Jesus Christ and then in new creation when all order will be established, non-order resolved and disorder resolved. New creation's not going back to Eden. New creation's boldly going where we've never gone before in Star Trek language. Immortal people would not need a tree of life. Now, it gets worse. Hold on to your hat, strap in. Okay, the pilot has not turned off the seatbelt sign. We have not yet arrived at the gate. Okay, look at Psalm 103. For he knows how we are formed. He remembers that we are dust. Formed in dust, the same vocabulary that we had in Genesis 2. But don't miss it. Look carefully. You don't have to read between the lines. Read the lines themselves. There's that very, very important little pronoun, we. You are formed from dust. I'm formed from dust. We are formed from dust. Every human being is formed from dust. I'm just reading the Bible. Paul says it too, the first man of dust and all from dust, 1 Corinthians 15. We are all formed from dust. Think of the ramifications, folks. Think of where this takes us. Being formed from dust does not describe material formation. It doesn't describe your material formation. It says a lot about who you are, who we all are. It's our identity. It's our mortality. It's our humanity. It says important things, but it is not a statement of material creation, of material formation, because you, unless Sydney is really a special place, we're all born of woman. Being formed from dust would not preclude being born of a woman. It doesn't for any of us. Do you see the ramifications of this? About what claims the Bible is making. Is the Bible making a claim about material human origins in this statement that Adam is formed from dust? No, it is not. This is not his material origin. It is his identity. It is all of our identity. And that's why I call it archetypal, because this is about all of us. This is not something that is uniquely true of only Adam. The Bible tells us otherwise. It is true of all of us. And if it's true of all of us, it is not a statement about material formation, because we know that we were born of woman. And there's no reason that Adam could not have been born of woman. So if we say, well, how would it work if Genesis 1 is about other people, and then we have Adam formed from dust, what's going on? Not material formation. We have to ask what role Adam is playing here. Now, we have this information in the ancient Near East a bit. Here's the Khnum, the creator god, creating the pharaoh on the potter's wheel. But as we can see from the left-hand side, this is a coronation scene. When it has Khnum creating, forming clay here, forming the pharaoh, this is not about his material origin. Forming pharaoh is not a statement about his material origin. It is about his identity as pharaoh, made to be king. You know, the Bible talks about the idea that the servant in Isaiah 44, Isaiah 49, how God says to the servant, I formed you in the womb to be my servant. Functional, not material. My son's at work again. Pharaoh is formed on the potter's wheel. We have archetypal ingredients throughout the ancient Near East. Blood, clay, spit, tears. There's a song about that, isn't there? Anyway, formation has a functional focus, not a material focus. And people in the ancient Near East are created en masse. Now, that doesn't mean it's got to be the same in Israel. After all, remember, in the ancient Near East, they were creating slave labor. If you can create slave labor, you're not going to just create two. You know, you're going to make a whole bunch of them. So, you know, Israel could be different. But likewise, if Israel has people created en masse, we wouldn't be surprised. Zechariah 12:1, the Lord's forming the human spirit. That's not material. Same verb, forms, same Hebrew verb. Not material. But yet there is a part of us that is spirit, that's not material. And God's in charge of that as well. We have to talk about woman, and then we'll be going to lunch, and we'll resolve all of this, solve all the problems this afternoon. Anyway, let's talk about woman here a moment. Question. Trick question, of course. Does Adam believe that Eve has been built from his rib? You know, you say, well, I'm inclined to say yes, so it must be no. And, of course, I'm going to tell you, I know that the answer is no, because the Bible tells me. You know, it's the old, the Bible tells me so. Adam's first words, bone of my bone, she is, and, flesh of my flesh. There's more than a rib going on here. Something else is happening. Bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. Now, that would lead us to say, well then, tell me about this word rib. See? Questions, observations, questions, analysis. See, this is our process. This word translated rib, tselah, never elsewhere refers to anatomy in the entire Hebrew Bible. So now we say, oh, now what are we going to do? So I have no idea what this word means. Well, no, we're not stuck entirely. The word is used quite often, not in anatomy, but in architecture. And in architecture, it represents one side of a pair. Talk about the north side and the south side, this side of the temple, that side of the temple, this side of the altar, that side of the altar. It talks about sides when there are two of them. Now that means that if God took one of Adam's sides, cut him in half. I just love that picture. Okay, he's cutting him in half. Now, here's a picture from this is a Hellenistic piece from a funeral, a funerary burial. And here, the figurine, you can see enough of it. The left side of the figurine is male, the right side is female. Interesting portrayal. I don't think they're doing Adam and Eve there, but just to show you how those things can work. So this is two sides. Now that would be fairly radical surgery. But what makes us think that an Israelite would think of surgery? You say, well, but wait a second, it says that God closed up the flesh. Yeah, that's true. I mean, could you see the sutures? I mean, what are we thinking here? Yeah, but God put Adam into a deep sleep. So do the Israelites know anything about anesthesiology? No, they don't. How is an Israelite thinking about this text? We have to ask. And by looking at the Hebrew words, we find information that might surprise us. The Hebrew word is tardema, a deep sleep. And it's used probably between verbs and nouns maybe 30 times. No, not that many, 15 to 20. And what we find is that one of the most significant things that it refers to is when someone is in a visionary state. That is, they're in a deep sleep so that God can show them something in the spiritual realm. They're unresponsive to the human realm. They're, keel over. Daniel does that. But that's so God can show them communication, something important. We take a look at Abraham in chapter 15. Remember, Abraham slices up the pieces of the animals? And then there's deep sleep, and the oven, he sees a vision of the torch in the oven passing through the pieces. And this is nothing less significant than the ratification of the covenant, arguably the most important event in the Old Testament. And God shows it in a vision. If Adam is in a deep sleep, it's not so he won't feel the surgical knife. It's rather so that God can show him a vision of something that's very important for him to understand. And so the text tells us, that is why a man leaves his father and mother and is united to his wife, and they become one flesh. Why is it that someone would leave the closest biological relationship they have, parents, children, in order to kind of start up a new family with an unrelated stranger? How's that work? And the text has an answer. It's because humanity, this is not talking about you as an individual human. This is corporate identity, which is how they always think in the ancient world. Corporate identity. Humanity is halves of a whole. When you leave your biological family and find a spouse, it's because you have this drive to that which originally you were. Halves of a whole. Humanity is gendered. Ontology trumps biology. You're going to return to your roots. And so when it says that they become one flesh, this is not a statement of what marriage is. This is a statement about the idea that you are returning to that one flesh that is the origins of humanity in terms of who you are as people. Is this just true of Adam and Eve? Of course not. It's true of everybody. That's the nature of the statement. It's true of everybody. So it's archetypal. Formed from dust, true of us all. Woman from man, true of us all. Originally one flesh, true of us all. That doesn't say that if you decide to be single or if you end up single, that you're somehow out of kilter. No, this is not about individuals. This is about humanity. This is about our identity. Now, what I'd like to do, we need to stop there. We're going to talk about the roles that God has for those people. And then we're going to go into the larger question about, okay, human origins, cosmic origins, Bible and science, and try to land the plane, okay? Bring those things home.